We are back, and we're going to play a song. I was talking to my sister Deanna this morning, and she was saying there's a song. It's taken from the musical New Americana, and it's called "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" And what she said is that's what got FDR elected, literally. That it was 2 years before, you know, he was elected president. So it was in, let's see here, it says, it's one of the best known American songs of the Great Depression, written in 1931 by lyricist E.Y. Yip Harburg. He wrote all of the songs from The Wizard of Oz as well, everybody, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, etc. And composer Jay Gorney. "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" was part of the 1932 musical New Americana. Okay. The melody is based on a Russian lullaby Gorney heard as a child. It became best known, however, through recordings by Bing Crosby and Rudy Vallée.
That's Rudy Valley.
Rudy Valley, excuse me. Well, if you want to play that, you play that. But both versions were released right before Franklin Delano Roosevelt's election to the presidency, and both became number one hits on the charts. The Brunswick Crosby recording became the best-selling record of its period and came to be viewed as an anthem of the shattered dream of the era. The song asks why the men who built the nation, built the railroads, built the skyscrapers, who fought in World War I, who tilled the earth, who did what their nation asked of them, should now that the work is done and their labor no longer necessary, find themselves abandoned in breadlines. It refers to Yankee Doodle Dum, a reference to patriotism, and the evocation of veterans also calls military bonuses, recalls military bonuses, which were a topical issue. Anyway, that's just a little piece. I just want to remind you that FDR was Jewish. He's an Ashkenazi Jew, no less. All right, just a little piece to contemplate because, you know, poverty and relegated to the bottom of the heap. Inequality is the issue of the day and every day. Here we go. And we're going to start today in the mountains of northern Georgia with our brother Richard. And I pass this. Hello, Richard. Greetings. How is it your way today? Greetings.
Well, it was a very fine day today.
Oh, good.
All things considered.
Good.
While it was 11 degrees this morning when I got up, it did get up into the 40s, so it was quite nice and sunny. All right. I've got about a four-page reading that I'm going to do after we listen to the Paley Report on Saturn in the fire signs. All right.
Oh.
So if you've got the chart handy at the end of the Paley Report, you might want to listen to this and take a look at your Leo, Sag, and Aries positions, because Saturn is now trining Aries and Leo. So let's go for Tom first, and we'll come back and do that, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Okay, Richard, thank you. Here we go.
Bueno, Buenos dias. This is Guy Poncho with the weekly Paleo Report. This is the Paleo Report for January 6th of 2015. The first one of the year. It's a windy day down here in Costa Rica. This is another backyard Paleo Report because there's just too much going on. This is actually like a week of recovery that's happening around here. I just got back from the playa and the madness and everything. It's been really an intense New Year's. I know if you're listening to this report, you're sensitive enough to have felt the energy that is going on now. That Sun conjunct Pluto last Saturday with the Mars opposite Jupiter, I talked about it in the report. It has been an extremely intense holiday season. Whoa, baby. There are no, and you know, we got that full moon happening yesterday, you know, on Monday, creating that grand cross. I talked about it last week. And I just want to get this sense of, I want to give you this sense of that we have gone through a Sun conjunct Pluto experience. This is what a Sun conjunct Pluto experience is like, going from the light of day down into the depths of the deep dark, leaving the light behind and coming into that cave. And now, guess what? It's over. It's done. It's time to re-emerge. We are now coming out of that Sun-Pluto conjunction, that full moon, that deep intensity. And not to say that it's over yet. I'm going to talk more about what's going on here. You know, there it's still going on for quite some time. The Uranus square Pluto is in effect until April, really. But in the meantime, this week there are not a lot of specific, direct, exact aspects. The moon is in Leo now, and it's going to oppose Mercury and Venus today, Tuesday, and then it moves on into Virgo on Thursday, coming into finally the third quarter square is going to be with the moon in late Libra around 23 degrees or so, the sun over there in Capricorn. That is happening, yeah, on Monday midnight, Tuesday, depends on where on planet Earth you are. It's around, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning in Costa Rica. So we have that moon traveling through those signs. And finally, you know, before I just talk about the bigger, broader picture, Mars leaves Aquarius and goes into Pisces next Monday. Yeah. So Mercury and Venus and Mars are all right now in Aquarius, with opposite to that Jupiter in Leo, and Mars is going to move out of there into Pisces. That's, you know, that's the big shift. And I'm going to find a little spot here and talk about it. Okay. Well, there's a couple of things to talk about here today. And it's almost as if there are two different realities going on simultaneously. And I'm going to see if I can explain these clearly, the way that I see them, the way that the astrology looks at them. We have what's going on that full moon yesterday. Okay, the Pluto-Uranus square, you know, squaring the moon's nodes, this grand cross in the cardinal signs. Action-oriented, result-oriented, goal-oriented, security-oriented, ego-oriented. I told you had choices to make, and this is this big time of, you know, like business, and is it going to happen or not, and is the money coming through, and are my plans going to be realized, and, you know, I've got to, like, do this and do that and do the other thing, and it's just been, like, really intensely heavy. And part of the thing about that, and part of the square, part of this tension, particularly with Uranus, surprises, unexpected events. This can be speed ups and slow downs, but one way or the other, our schedules, which we tend to like hold on to for a sense of security, predictability, you know, like, okay, I thought this was going to come then, and I thought then I was after that, I was going to do this, and da, 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 and what I thought and the plans that I had, and but there's been like delays, hold ups, hold back. And there's, you know, and it's just been like, what is going on? And there's, and then we can begin to doubt our plans, doubt ourselves, doubt our, you know, if we're in the flow, if we're fighting the flow, what should I do? We can go into panic mode, okay, with these kind of aspects going on. Now, this Mars opposite Jupiter just wants to, like, go. Make it happen, see it happen, like overnight, automatically, bam. So this is like this cardinal cross, this tension that's been going on, and it's going to continue, like I said, for the next couple of months, but really peaking around the middle of January when Pluto comes into exactly square the moon's nodes. From the 15th to the 20th of January, we're really kind of building up. Yeah. Even more coming closer to this intersection or the crossroads of our lives. So it's no accident. And it's very interesting to note that at the same time, this cardinal cross, Uranus square Pluto, moon's nodes, all this kind of stuff going on, right? On the surface of things, we could say, there's also behind the scenes, underneath that, Chiron, Neptune in Pisces, squaring Saturn that just came into Sagittarius, which is squaring Black Moon Lilith over here in Virgo. And this is kind of this T-square going on with Black Moon Lilith, Neptune, and Saturn. Is a horse of a completely different color. This is in the mutable signs, okay? And these are underworld characters, okay? Neptune is the collective unconscious, yeah? Black Moon Lilith is our inner shadow of our rejected self. These two in opposition, and that opposition builds over the next couple of weeks. She only moves like 3 degrees a month. So it's all the month, the whole month of January. Black Moon Lilith is opposite Neptune. I can go into that maybe in my community longer video. I'll go into this Black Moon Lilith Neptune thing this month. But and then squaring Saturn. Saturn goes up. It doesn't exactly square Neptune until like November of this year. But it comes up to, you know, within a degree or so by March. So underneath this undertow, this undercurrent, is a deep healing of the collective unconscious. And that collective unconscious has been wounded through the patriarchy, through thousands of years of religious conditioning, through thousands of years of suppressing our natural spirit, instinctive, animal, true, mother, feminine, inner self. In order to be or achieve some kind of external heaven or outside reward through the denial and oppression. Saturn, this is, you know, Saturn is Neptune. This is all like so self-denying, so ego-denying, so, you know, inwardly feminine denying. Very interesting. And so we're coming from a place of feeling very separated from source, being very unholy, immoral, unethical, guilty, ashamed of ourselves. There's underneath, I'm saying, this is like Pandora's box of the collective unconscious. And this underlying stuff, it's really something. Because what we can be doing now, and what I think the universe is doing, forcing us in a way, pushing our butts, putting our nose to the smell of the nasty stuff, man. It's like, here, look at this. When we get delays and we get hindrances and we get obstacles, sometimes it's not that we're doing something wrong or that we have to try harder or work more or push or this, that, or the other thing. We need to flow. And we need to believe and trust in Mother Nature, in life herself, that this is a time, yeah, that we're not getting what we want when we thought we wanted it or how the schedule was, blah, 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 because it's time to feel and not be distracted by all of our doing and all of our iPads and our emails and our businesses and our da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that there is a lot of deep shit going on now that needs to surface, that needs to be felt, that needs to be released. And it's not comfortable, and it's not easy to look at, and it's like we don't want to feel it. So this is a real time where the buzz is on, and part of the stress is this unconscious, subconscious psyche. It's really fear. It says, oh no, man, I got to get that going. I got to get this going. I got to get this business. I got to get this money. I got to get this happening. I got to keep all my distractions happening that keep me out of my center, because in my center is my wound that wants to be felt, that needs to be felt right now. So we can all be grasping for one addiction or one distraction or one movie or one project or one business or one orgasm or one something to pull us out of really going into the grief, the loss, the humanness. We're like changing seasons. We're changing ages. Uh-huh. And yep. Changing ages means really letting go of our ancestors' stuff. Yep. Old DNA programs from thousands of years. It's like this is big medicine. This is big work going on. And Earth. And fire, and working with the elements of water, fire, earth, and air. Do your incense, do your aromatherapy, do your crystal healing, do your, crystal bowls. Sit out in nature, sit in the mountain, watch. It's really, somebody's got to be kind of holding the core here. Somebody has to be the elders here. We can't all just like be going off and, oh, Happy New Year parties and, balloons and, in some ways this age of Aquarius can be pretty distracting. Let's not forget, our minds go at 100 miles an hour and our emotions go at 5 miles an hour. And when we're lost in our heads, we're wanting to move and go faster, 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 more, 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 more. I'm addicted to stimulation. And when I don't get stimulated enough, I start to feel some of these slower, deeper emotions that come up to the surface. And it's like, ah, give me more, give me more, give me more, give me more, give me more stimulation. Get me back in my head again. But once we let go of some of those thoughts, of some of those addictions, of some of those plans, of some of those needs, we can get into a deeper center, core, power, kundalini, root, force, energy. Black Moon Lilith in Virgo is the integrated, powerful medicine woman. And we can really, when we get into this place, we are the eye of the tornado. We are the eye of the storm. We are in our center. We are in our core. And we are not overwhelmed. And we are not afraid. And we are not freaking out. And we are not stressed. So this is a time, these next couple of months, the Black Moon, Lilith, Saturn, Neptune are calling us in, calling us down into the dark inner world of the feminine feeling nature. And our society and our military and our newspapers and our computer corporations and our news agencies are all wanting us to stay busy, occupied, lost, overwhelmed, freaked out. So it's like, and it's all a fucking illusion. Don't get lost in the illusion of all the action.
Oh, man. Wow.
It all sounds so serious. So, the mantra for today then is, sometimes, shit, you know, I got so much going on, I can't even remember my own freaking mantra, man. Sometimes when I feel I need to fix this or that, it's really trust in spirit I lack. I'm going to change the feel to think. Yeah. Sometimes when I think I need to fix this or that, it's really trust in spirit that I lack. You know what I'm saying? Our ego, our thinking is a slave, a tool, an instrument of our ego. And our ego lives in separation from spirit and exclusion and survival mode. And like, I need to like survive and protect myself, and I need to fix and control and establish and form and, you know, judge and blah, blah, blah. I need to do the ego and the mind and the thinking is all about fixing and straightening and ordering and scheduling and completing and blah, 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 blah. And sometimes, I'm not saying all the time, but sometimes we can get into this space, you know, and think, delude ourselves, fool ourselves to thinking, oh yeah, this is real and I need, this is a real threat or this is a real catastrophe or this is a real disaster, when in fact, dude, give me a break, it's not. it's actually our fear, it's our ego that is afraid of losing. Our spirit is eternal and our soul is connected to all that is. When we get in our core and we get in our center and we get in our feelings and we trust, not just some external spirit or, you know, guru, teacher, God, goddess out there. No, when you're in your center and when you're in your core, you trust yourself. And then that is the source of relaxation. Trusting in yourself that you are connected. When I feel connected and when I feel in my core and in my center, I trust myself. I trust that I'm a part of spirit. And I trust that life is good for me, is supporting me. And everything that happens is just right according to my soul plan. I hope I'm saying this right. Jesus. It's kind of bizarre. Sometimes when I think I need to fix this or that. It's really trust in spirit I lack. Namaste. Aloha. Have a good week with so much love.
Okay. Next week, in brief, Moon goes into Libra tomorrow around 7 a.m. Eastern time zone. Mars goes into Pisces Monday early morning, 5:20. Uh-huh. And the Moon is opposite Uranus Monday morning at 8:42. Moon goes into Pisces Tuesday, dinner time, 6:44 p.m. And Venus sextiles Uranus at 3 in the afternoon. Wednesday, Moon in Scorpio, Mercury sextile Uranus at 5:30 in the morning. And then the Moon is going to trine Neptune, square Mercury, sextile Pluto, and square Venus all on Wednesday. So, and then we got Moon in Scorpio Thursday as well. And then overnight, early a.m., Mars will exactly square Saturn. And the Moon will square Jupiter at 9:30 in the morning on the East Coast. Friday, Moon goes into Sagittarius at 3 a.m., and conjuncts Saturn at 7:11 a.m. And the Moon will be in Sagittarius when we get here next Saturday. All right. So since Saturn has gone into Sagittarius, I'm going to read this little bit. This is from a book called Saturn, A New Look at an Old Devil by Liz Green, L-I-Z Green with an E on the end. And this is published by Samuel Weiser. And she's, I think she's still alive. This one she copyrighted in 76. All right, so here's what she has to say about Saturn in the fiery signs and houses. The element of fire is related to the function of the intuition and is often linked with spirit energy and the initial source of life and consciousness. This rather exalted conception of fire may be considered too lofty for our more personalized examples of Aryan aggression, Leonian pride and autocracy, and Sagittarian irresponsibility. However unsavory our individual examples may be, all three fire signs tend to possess an innate consciousness of their individuality and often have limitless vitality, self-confidence, and enthusiasm, which stems not from any mundane accomplishment, but from an intuitive perception of the worth of the self. Earth expresses confidence when it has acquired mastery over matter, and water expresses confidence when it has established meaningful emotional bonds. Air expresses confidence through the exchange and development of ideas. But the fiery temperament needs no further justification than its existence for the innate belief that life is essentially meaningful and that man deserves the best from it. This sense of inner purpose or meaning, which we tend to call the urge for self-expression without fully understanding what self we are speaking of, underlies the behavior and outlook of all three fiery signs and houses. And I'm going to skip a little bit here just to save some time. Fire is not a difficult element to understand if we consider the concept of a total self which possesses will and purpose and of which the conscious personality is only a fragment. This is both a psychological and an esoteric postulate, although psychologically, politely avoids the use of the word soul, except in a limited sense. We may see the expression of this fiery self in a more personal and human way through the urge to explore and conquer, as it is displayed by Aries, the urge to create and to love, as it is displayed by Leo, and the urge to expand and understand, as it is displayed in Sagittarius. In each of these signs, there is a deep sense of purpose and an innate acceptance of the fact that the ordinary arenas of life, body, feelings, and mind, exist solely for the self-expressive urges of the creative self. All the world is to the fiery trigon, indeed a stage to be explored, acted upon, understood, and loved, and when necessary, destroyed, so that new forms may be built. For there is value only in the meaning, and it is the meaning which is always sought in every experience. Skip a few sentences. Fire perpetually seeks purpose and generally finds it, although he often lacks an appreciation of the myriad of beautiful forms in which the purpose is couched. He is naturally first concerned with the purpose of his own life. Mm-hmm. Saturn in the fiery signs or houses, that's 1, 5, and 9.
Right? 9.
Leo's 5. Sag is 9.
Aries is 1.
We're, yeah, and we're in an 8 year. Saturn leaves Scorpio as we run into an 8 year. Saturn in the fiery signs or houses tends to suggest a barrier between the conscious personality and the intuitive perception of the self as it is ordinarily experienced by fire. This often precipitates a loss of the sense of one's innate purpose and significance in the broader context of life. Saturn in fire may appear to produce problems which are more philosophical than real in nature, but it should be remembered that Saturn in any element brings out the importance of understanding and experiencing the meaning and sphere of that element. To the person with Saturn in a fiery sign or house, the consciousness of the self is a tremendously important issue, although he may not verbalize his need in such terminology. Often, compulsive self-centeredness is a byproduct of this frustration and search for meaning and purpose. It is not that there is too much ego in the sense of the term. The individual is not selfish in the way that we popularly refer in our tirades to those people who do not do what we want. There is, in fact, too little ego. And this loss of contact with the center of the psyche tends to rob the individual of his confidence in life. He will often mask this loss with an exaggerated sense of his own importance, for he has nothing else. Saturn is in his fall in Aries and in detriment in Leo, for he does not initially get on well with the element of fire. All right. Being in fall, that's the worst place for Saturn to express itself. And being in Leo, detriment, not necessarily good, or we could say it's difficult with Saturn in Leo. But we're talking about Saturn in Sag. It is easy enough to see Saturn in the role of the Lord of Karma, but to perceive him as merely an instrument of suffering and the payment of debt is only a possible part of the picture. If Saturn is seen as a motive leading to a process which results in growth, then it is easier to comprehend the reason for his apparent restrictions in any area of life. If it is instead seen as a challenge where the individual can, through effort and the development of the intuitive faculty, begin to apprehend his true nature and his true role in relation to the group and to life in general, accompanied by the destruction or elimination of those values which are no longer of use or which are based on illusion, then he can make use of his opportunity and develop that aspect of his temperament which, symbolically, will yield the alchemical gold. Okay. Let's see. The sun is exalted in the sign of Saturn's fall. All right, sun's exalted in Aries, Saturn's fall. For the conscious personality is strengthened by its contact with the larger self. These two opponents, sun and Saturn, who sometimes take the guise of God and the devil, perpetually circle each other about the ring, whether they are an actual aspect on the birth chart or not. They are two faces of the same basic principle, and in the individual's psychology, they are related to the conscious personality and the shadow or unconscious personality. The sun's face looks outward to the world, while Saturn's two faces look both toward the sun and downward toward the darkness of the collective unconsciousness of the race. See, and that's we were doing a lot of that when this last 2.5 years with Sun in Scorpio. Okay. And that's, let's see here, last paragraph here. It may then be suggested that Saturn in Aries, or the first house, is connected with the understanding and development of the will or sense of purposeful activity. Saturn in Leo, or the fifth house, is connected with the understanding and development of creativity or sense of purposeful love. And Saturn in Sagittarius, or the ninth house, is connected with the understanding and development of intuitive perception and wisdom. That's the one we're doing the next 2.25 years. These may appear to be abstruse definitions of Saturn and fire, but they are a fitting introduction to a symbol which suggests the opportunity for the development of an intuitive understanding of the purpose of one's life. So there you go. Huh. And this is she does a whole long chapter on Saturn and each of the four elements. But we don't have time for that. And that's getting more into your personal chart, you know.
Very good. Let us know. Yeah, it was nice to let us know what the nature of Saturn is in relationship to all the fire signs.
Yeah. But the key here is the understanding and development of creative and purposeful love. That's the Leo. And in Sagittarius, it's connected with the understanding and the development of intuitive perception and wisdom. So the world needs a whole lot of the development of intuitive perception and wisdom.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Yes, one needs a sense of direction and purpose. That's agreed upon.
And I'm going to do a little check here. So Saturn spends roughly 29 and a half years in a sign to go around the zodiac. So I'm going to change. I'm going to go back to the year 1985. It's 30 years ago.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah. Let's see. In 1985, Saturn, in January 85, Saturn was in 26 Scorpio. Mm. All right, so.
Hmm.
We had a few months to that, and Saturn went into Sagittarius in the middle of 1985. Oh, yeah, and then January 10th, 1985, Mars was conjunct Venus in Pisces, and it was squaring Uranus was in Sagittarius back in 85.
Neptune. What does all that mean?
Well, again, it's this divine will challenging. Okay? We've been dealing with Uranus and Aries, but roughly 40 years ago, maybe, Uranus was going into Sag. And there was a whole lot of enlightenment going on in the late 80s, right? We had the convergence. Remember all that?
Yeah. That was about 30 years ago, though. A little less.
I'm looking at, yeah. When was that convergence?
87.
It was
August 16th, 17th, 1987.
Yeah. We'll see. If I punch in August 87.
You know, I took ecstasy with Zargos.
Anyway, all right. Have you got anything? We got about 10 minutes left.
Well, just that there's a lot of sightings going on. I don't know if you can say what astrology has to say about that. There was this one. In Maryland, two Maryland witnesses driving northbound on I-95 near Elliott City Ramp reported watching a triangular-shaped UFO that moved directly overhead and hovered over nearby trees. According to the testimony in case number 62426 from the Mutual UFO Network, or UFON.
MUFON.
I mean, that's our older gentleman's website. What's his name? He's been
Bruce
on our
Filer?
Bruce Filer. Yeah, I think so. He was on the citizens' hearings too.
Mm-hmm.
The reporting witness was driving on a return trip to Pennsylvania with his mother in the front seat passenger side at approximately 3:55 in the morning, December 29th, when the object was first seen. Quote, I noticed a large bright light glide over Interstate 95, almost directly over our car, just enough to get my attention. The witness stated, I was driving about 70 miles per hour and pressed my face against the front windshield to get a better look at it. The triangular-shaped object seemed to slow down and then hovered over a group of nearby trees. The witness described the object. Quote, to my amazement, I saw a triangular shaped craft with two oval lights in the back corners of the craft and a large red light in the center. I could also see and make out a very dark point on the craft, which I thought to be the front of it or the tip of the triangle. The object then stopped and hovered over a group of trees. I quickly screamed to my sleeping mother in the passenger seat to look out her window. She woke up and immediately saw what I was yelling about. She was mesmerized. The driver got a good look at the object. I was trying to look at the craft and the road at the same time. Not good. And that was when I noticed, that the edges of the craft were more rounded, almost like a popsicle stick. It had two layers. On the bottom was the color of the cloudy night sky, and the top was a very brilliant, shiny black color. The driver attempted to get a photo of the object. I fumbled for my phone that had a camera attached to it, and my mom watched as it hovered over the group of trees. It hovered only about 5 or 10 feet over the treetops. That is really low.
That is
really That's outrageous. Yeah. She got a better view of the craft and said that the red light in the center of the V was very unusual and very large and red. Just as the witness attempted to take a photo of the object, it disappeared. As the witness attempted to take a shot with the camera, something unusual occurred. As I took out the camera to take the picture, I aimed the camera toward it. Yet it went from a stationary position above the tree to completely disappearing out of view, and I couldn't get the picture taken. The driver's mother seemed to think the camera had something to do with the UFO disappearing. Could be, huh? Don't take a picture of me.
Right.
She told me that as I took out the camera and aimed it, it was almost as though the UFO knew I was about to take a picture and took off. We both became very excited from what we had just seen, and then I took notice of the time, and it read 3:55 a.m. The approaching exit was that of, when it was seen, was that of the Elliott City off-ramp. Elliott City is an unincorporated community in Howard County, Maryland, population 65,834. That's the end of that story. That's pretty interesting. And then we saw some footage of a rather large craft hovering, or moving actually with the traffic. It was a little bit higher up. It wasn't that low. But it was right over the LA Highway number 5.
Yeah.
I'm just going, what's this? It was as plain as the nose on your face. And exactly what did they say again? David Icke was on the Taryn Loveway show.
No, they didn't talk about that.
That was Craig Barnes' show. Who was it that talked about Edward Snowden and...
That was Craig Barnes.
Edward Snowden and Julian Assange are going to... download a huge file of Starship sightings.
Yeah.
Like a lot. In the most recent times, they're going to just nail them all around the globe. And I'm just saying, you know, they're talking about those guys in the news, you know, and the Fox News is growling at them, and everybody else is saying, we better pay attention. We've learned a lot from these guys. You said that Julian Assange was speaking somewhere. Where was that?
From his embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
Yeah, I know. What did he have to say?
Julian Assange talked about the hundreds of thousands of
sightings. That many?
Yes.
In the last
little while.
That's a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, like in the last year, 2014 till now.
That's really a lot.
And what we're not being told by our so-called NASA, which is a front for a very dark agency.
And what was so interesting is that Kay Pacha said we're out of that dark tunnel now. Uh-huh. So, folks, look up.
Yes, just look up.
Sometimes as I think I need to fix this or that, it's really just trust in spirit I lack. With Neptune Chiron in Pisces, we are all becoming more sensitive to the veils as the veils are pulled back. We can all slip easily into overwhelm and freak out. Yet really, let's look at it. Do we really need to freak out about this or that? Really? Maybe we need to look at what we are so attached to. With Venus ruling the North Node, now in Aquarius, it is time for some objective witnessing. Hundreds of thousands of craft, I'm ready.
Yeah. Witnessing
of our lives to be happening. This is most easily accomplished with some trust in a greater intelligence. This fits perfect. Than our limited entity. Time to rise and shine. Enjoy. 7:56. You got any wise thing to say? A Sabian symbol or anything?
Oh, we can always grab a Sabian symbol.
I love those things. Let's do that.
As a matter of fact, thanks for reminding me. We ought to look at the first couple of degrees of Sagittarius.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, thank you, Richard.
All right. All right. All right, Sagittarius, the first half is, it's scene 17, and the key word there for the first half of Sagittarius is abstraction. And Sagittarius 1 is retired Army veterans gather to reawaken old memories. Some things we do not want to forget because we do not want to repeat history, right?
Right.
2 degrees, white-capped waves display the power of wind over sea. This keynote is the mobilization of unconscious energies under the pressure of superpersonal motives. All right. 3 degrees is two men playing chess. The transcendent ritualization of conflict. Four degrees is a little child learning to walk with the encouragement of his parents. And this is the natural assistance. I like this. The natural assistance of superior powers during crises of growth. That fits for the whole world, doesn't it? We could sure use some natural assistance of superior powers during the current crises of growth.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's good, Richard. Thirty seconds.
All right. 5 degrees, an old owl sits alone on the branch of a large tree. A poised and wise approach to existence based on a clear perception of unconscious factors and their operation.
Ooh, that's good. All right. I think we should stop there. Everybody, let's continue on the other side in our conference line. Tonight it'll be 860-970-0300. And the PIN code this evening is 13729#. And let's dance with that one. I like that one. Great, Richard. Thank you so much, everybody. We'll see you there. And then at the top of the next hour, on BBS Radio Station 2, best radio in the universe. Namaste. day before yesterday, I think it was, up there in Maine. It was literally 30 below zero, and the wind chill factor was 70 below zero. Unbelievable. And then I was asking our brothers over there at Paradise, California, earlier today, I said, how's the weather? Oh, he says 65 degrees. It's beautiful. Think about that, everybody. 70 below zero with the wind chill factor in Maine and 65 degrees on the other side of this this one little continent, one little country. General Betrayus. I know we got to talk about some more of these naughty kids. Our brother Thomas here, he was just saying, when, and our sister Dina, when? I just want to know when.
Dates.
When, what? No dates. And it just makes me remember because, you know, the ebb and the flow of the I Ching and the astrology is real time, what's going on. And, you know, we've been going through this nightmarish sort of time where it comes to the, here, Kay Pacha, I'll just read that again, says, sometimes as I think, I need to fix this or that. It's really just trust in spirit I lack. With Neptune and Chiron in Pisces, we are all back, becoming more sensitive to the veil, as the veils are being pulled back. So, okay, we know the veils are being pulled back. And then it goes on and it says, we can all slip easily into overwhelm and freak out. And I could feel it in the tone of everybody's voice. Dina says, is anything going to happen this year, next year, 20 years? People are getting antsy in the pantsy. Yet really, let's look at it. Do we really need to freak out about this or that? Really? Maybe we need to look at what we are so attached to. With Venus ruling the North Node now in Aquarius, it is indeed time for some objective witnessing of our lives to be happening. This is most easily accomplished with some trust in the greater intelligence than our limited ego identity. Time to rise and shine. And this is the last day of this past week of the I Ching. Nonetheless, it's still the last day. And it says for Gui Mai, G-U-I, capital M-E-I, subordinate, converting, number 54. Above is Zen, Z-H-E-N, shake, excite, inspire. Below is Dewey, D-U-I, open, free, unhindered. The wisdom, your energy has been usurped. Do not attempt to ingratiate oneself with others who have control. Moi? Again, capiche. You know, and it just repeats it over and over again. This hex grand signifies a maiden who was to be married into an influential household. She is advised not to make waves, rather for the time being to subordinate herself to the family until she has achieved a deeper level of maturity, of clarity, and of contemplation. Only then would she be able to make her move. Look at this example as it symbolically applies to our present situation. We have worked hard for a desired goal or union. It will be destructive to exert our influence at this time, as the energy of dynamic change is, for the moment, locked, held in bondage. This is not the time to express our inner truth, though we can see it well just over the horizon. As we try to be the truth talker now, our words do not get heard, and they will be construed as being negative and counterproductive. Did you hear that, Tommy? We would then lose the opportunity to join with the tribe of our choice, those who have, for the right reasons, chosen us. We are in the energy of maturation, no matter what age we are or how much experience we have, clocked on the trail. Okay, I don't need to read the whole thing again. Here's another little piece. Although we have learned and experienced much on the path of our goal, we still need the maturity of having the deep and perhaps mystical knowledge of the situation, so that at the proper time we can step up and have the influence that will bring the relationship, the business, or the tribe into a successful position. It is here that we will be subtlety, influence the sacred journey leading to the goals we have all desired and are in harmony with the greater good. For now, metaphorically, bow our heads while we determine the lay of the land. We did that all afternoon here. That was intense, what we did all afternoon here. Right, Rama?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't funny. It was, I'm just going to say it again. We have never had that kind of a look. Yes, we had to insert some things that they haven't quite gotten to, assuming that heads were chopped off that never were. Right. Yeah, assuming that it's, you know, this way or that way, this or that.
Yeah, like what's his name said.
Like what, Rama?
Like Mr. Kaipacha said, this or that.
Yes, like Kaipacha said, you know, when we're thinking, when we're in our heads, hurry up, I got to go do this and I got to go do that. It's time for that mystical knowledge, that experience, the high heart. Quiet the ego, meditate, feed the soul, chill, bide your time. Tommy said, I have all the time in the world. And then the next sentence, Noel, our long-range plans, in the quiet of contemplation, silently make our plans. Our time of influence is not yet. Not yet does not mean never. It means that energies are not properly aligned for us to have influence on the situation. Be a part of the nameless crowd or a member of the team that works diligently yet does not try to show its greatness or cleverness. Okay, I'm just going to jump. Rama, come here. Rama, let's get the Kumbh Mela. Let's do that. We're going to join a crowd, all right. The Kumbh Mela last year, Diana said she believes it was the 144th gathering. In other words, every 12 years, 144 times. I'm just saying, how do we do that? So 12 times 144, isn't that how you do that? Just to find out how many years? Two fours are eight, two fours are eight, two ones are two, one four is four, one four is four, one one is one. 8, 12, 7, 1,728 years of gathering at the Ganges and this other major river that comes from the high mountains. And it's up in the Hindu Kush. Or no, it's just a little bit, it's around in the Indus Valley, isn't it? Mm-hmm. A little bit south of the Hindu Kush, more in the valley, but just a little bit south. I would imagine that this year it would be not too much fun, so I'm glad it was able to happen last year because they have had some horrendous monsoons this year. Yet, again, times 100,000 times 100,000, you know, we're talking about the 144,000 when we invoke the highest of high of energies. So this is something that the human race has done, have literally walked the talk. So let's take that into mind. How you spell this is K-U-M, as in Mary, B-H, as in Harry, and then a space, and then Mela, M as in Mary, E-L-A. So, and this was on PBS. Let's just join them. The hosts of heaven don't ignore 100 million people getting their act together and from all over the world and in the highest of bringing in the age of enlightenment now. Let's draw that through. And as Kay Pacha said, we just came out of a, you know, like a cave, you know, like a time that was really tough and difficult. And so tomorrow afternoon, can go to the iChingweekly.com. Is it .com or .org?
.com.
.com. The iChing Weekly, weekly.com. Later on in the afternoon, on Sunday afternoon, you should be able to get it. And then we can see what the next week brings us. It's not going to make it come any faster for whining and, you know, getting all judgmental. It's not about that at all. This is a galactic operation where there is no time as we know it here, and that's the case. So here we go. Without further ado, let's take our moment here in time here. Kumbha Mela. Oh, let me read that little piece.
Okay.
Just pull it up. Just read at the beginning. It says, every 12 years, tens of millions of men, women, and children gather on the floodplain of the Ganges and the Yamuna rivers in Allahabad, India. A-L-L-A-H-A-B-A-D, Allahabad, India, for the Kumbha Mela, the largest gathering of humanity for religious purpose on the planet. Pilgrims come from across India and around the world to bathe in the water where the two sacred rivers meet. Such mass bathing in the Ganges has been recorded for over 2,500 years. This is the Hindu religion practice. Go down some more. I'm going to read that stuff down there. The earliest pilgrimage on record was 629 A.D. to 645 A.D. Wow. That's a lot of walking, folks. The frequency every 4 years and then every 12 years in the city of Allahabad. The duration, it's 55 days long. People live by the Ganges River. 55 days. When humanity does something like that in the collective, and the participants is more than 100 million every year, yet every 12 years is the cycle where it builds to this 144th time, 144th year. That's 144th period of 12 years each. And this is a, what's that last thing on that list? This is in honor of Lord Vishnu. There's Brahma, the creator. There's Shiva, the destroyer. And there's Vishnu, the preserver. Okay, so this is called Sacred Journeys with Bruce Feller. Let's go now.
the Ganges River at the largest gathering of humanity on the planet. Every 12 years, tens of millions of people gather over 50 days to bathe in these waters. A reminder that faith can still move the world.
This year, among the 100 million expected at Kumbh Mela, are American pilgrims on a journey of discovery.
It doesn't matter that the crowd is 1 million or 50 million. It's the undercurrent of devotion.
They come to experience, but also to question.
It's an atmosphere that's so saturated with reverence and gratitude.
Can they draw closer to their God?
My aim is to understand God.
Today, organized religion is more threatened than ever. Yet pilgrimage is more popular than ever. I'm Bruce Weiler. In this epic series, I travel with American pilgrims on 6 historic pilgrimages. I bathe in the rivers of India, dance in the heart of Africa, cleanse in the waters of Lourdes, trek through the temples of Japan, and walk in the footsteps of prophets in Mecca and Jerusalem. I attend some of the most spectacular and moving human gatherings on earth, and I ask, what can these journeys tell us about the future of faith? At a Hindu temple in Los Angeles, Shambhu Misra and his wife Peggy are preparing to make the epic trek to Kumbh Mela. The two have been on a lifelong search for meaning. Shambhu was born a Hindu in India, Peggy a Christian in the United States. But as an adult, she grew attracted to Indian religion. For both, the Kumbh Mela is a way to deepen their faith and bring to life the questions they've been asking since they were first married.
I was brought up Catholic. I knew from early childhood that that wasn't the right religion for me. I didn't understand it. There were so many rules. And I remember hoping that somebody would explain it to me, but they didn't answer the questions.
I was raised a Hindu. For me, the dogma part, the ritual part was not as appealing as the spiritual side of the Hinduism, which really what one should be capturing and trying to practice, you know.
They will be joined on their journey by other pilgrims from across the United States.
To do a spiritual journey, I think, is an amazing opportunity to deepen your spiritual practice.
You know, it's going to be great being in the middle of millions of people, all trying to bring in their convictions and their spirituality.
In Miami, another group of pilgrims is also preparing to go to the largest gathering on Earth. Carmen Plasencia is a yoga instructor.
The Kumbh Mela Festival, it's where all the saints and the gurus and the holy men and women gather.
One of the main factors of being at the Kumbh Mela is the bathing days, and we happen to be timing our trip that we're there on one of the main bathing days, which is the new moon. And that means there's going to be upwards to 14 million people going through that location in one day.
Sadhu Singh, also a yoga teacher, has been to the Kumbh Mela before. But for Carmen and the rest of the group, this is their first time.
The experience of being able to take a group to India, most of us our first time, is just a dream.
The pilgrims come from all walks of life. Among them is 23-year-old medical student Jamie Zimmerman.
The idea of being around all of that spiritual energy and doing so with millions of other people is such a powerful, sacred journey, and I can't imagine anything more magical than that. It's very exciting.
The Kumbh Mela Festival takes place every 12 years in the city of Allahabad in North India. The location is the confluence of two sacred rivers, the Yamuna and the Ganges. I'm meeting Shambhu, Peggy, and their group 75 miles downstream at the site of India's holiest city, Varanasi. Hindus are called to visit Varanasi at least once in their lives to bathe in its sacred waters. It's also considered the holiest place on earth for Hindu cremation because the body's ashes can be sprinkled into the sacred river. Like many holy cities, religion is not an afterthought here. It's front and center. With funeral processions, images of ancient gods and goddesses. To come here is to consider your place in the world. To understand the role of religion in modern India, I'm meeting American historian Michael Dodson.
So this is where people come at the start of the journey.
Is this where people come to start a journey?
The first thing he does is take me to one of the city's hundreds of temples, carrying an offering of flowers and fruit. It's a ritual many travelers perform at the start of a sacred journey, beginning their travels with blessings of safe passage.
It's about opening yourself up for what you're about to do and ensuring that you take the right start and to ask permission and to get the blessings of Shiva.
Shiva is one of millions of gods in Hinduism, each represented by multiple forms. But behind these many deities, there is an overarching one God.
Hinduism is a monotheistic religion, by and large. There is one God, you know, but the way we approach that one God is multiple. So it is as God can be as individual as people.
What I find so interesting is, right, when the British came here, I think they found this a little bit alien. But if you then cut to today, hundreds of years later, there's something about this system that seems incredibly contemporary, right? When we live in this age where everybody is, in a sense, making their own way in religion, Hinduism seems the perfect paradigm for that because it invites you to make your own way, find your own representations, and make your own individual relationship with the divine. It seems incredibly contemporary.
I think that's a really good way to think about it. It's both a community, right? It's a social system, but it's also highly individual in some ways.
This openness of Hinduism to interpretation is one reason for its appeal and its mystery.
Hinduism is difficult to define because it does not have a single founder, a different set of texts, or a single set of beliefs. We can look back and say Hinduism is that dynamic, interconnected set of traditions and have loosely overlapping sets of beliefs, practices, texts, cultural values, norms, and aesthetic history.
A key part of that faith is that life is a cycle of living, dying, and reincarnation. Each rebirth is dependent on how the previous life was lived. Pilgrimages bring you into contact with that cycle, and in Varanasi, to their ultimate symbol, human ash.
Tell me about these marks, ash. What's that about?
The ash is cremation ash. And the paints...
So this is someone's dead body in my heart.
It's likely the wood from a cremation. Partly that's the symbol of the circularity of life.
Ash has got a very particular significance. Wearing it and smearing it on yourself means that you've become born again.
Because each soul can go on for eons, the purpose of human life is to get closer to God, to build up good karma for the soul, until it can be released from the cycle of human suffering and death, and achieve unity with the divine.
We are here in these bodies this time around. Our inner essence, soul if you like, we'll come back around again and again and again in another form and another form and another form. It's a cyclical view of time.
For believers, a pilgrimage to the Kumbh Mela is a way to increase your spiritual awareness, to strengthen your karma and move toward a higher and higher state of being. Like all sacred journeys, a visit to this holy place is a chance to step out of your everyday and inch yourself closer to the transcendent reunion with God. Shambhu, Peggy, and their group arrive in Varanasi and immediately make their way through the chilly dawn air for their first glimpse of India's sacred river. It's part of their preparation for the journey.
Before going for any pilgrimage, we have the cup of tea, and then we go. Take bath in Ganga, come back again. Again, have a cup of tea.
This is the most holy city on the planet right now. So this is where all the saints and all the sages come, you know? So we're honored to be here. Very honored.
And it's a land of spirituality, so we're all hoping to capture some of that.
Sacred clothing is part of many pilgrimages. Here, it's Hindu prayer shawls, printed with sacred texts.
Taking bath in Ganga is a kind of religious bath. Once we will go near the river, you will realize how important that bath is for those people. How is it? Okay. Okay, please.
While taking a ritual bath at the Kumbh Mela is the peak of the pilgrimage, first there is a course of readying yourself for the experience.
We're hoping to deepen our spiritual progress as we are at Kumbh. I think most of us are doing the same thing here too.
For Shambhu, a businessman, the process is gradual. Sue Kenny is an ecologist from Colorado.
It feels so ancient, you know, and so... There's a lot of deep, deep spirituality here, and that's what I'm trying to tune into.
For Judy Samos, a former nurse and health executive from California, the challenge is to prepare for a new stage of life.
My soul always seeks to be with other souls that are on the same journey. My aim at this stage of my life is to more and more understand God. I like to think of it as a wheel where there's the center which we all look for, and then all these spokes in the different ways we each approach that search. What I think to take back is a transformed Judy.
And so, each of these pilgrims prepares for the journey. If organized religion often obliges believers to conform and comply, a pilgrimage frees them and invites them to figure it out for themselves. In the West, so much of religion has been about go to a building at a time the building chooses and read from a set script. Whereas on a pilgrimage, all that's stripped away. You're out on your own. Even if you're in a group, you're on a personal journey. And that journey almost compels you to ask, what do I believe? Later that evening, we all gather for a huge communal celebration on the famed river steps of Varanasi. Here, every night, is a colorful ceremony of the lamps, or aarti, one of Hinduism's most ancient rituals. At water's edge, pilgrims make offerings to Mother Ganges, which is both a river and a goddess.
Religion has always been good at spectacle, the smoke, the light, the color. Just a little rupture in the day to stop, come together, and celebrate.
I'm struck that the basic language of this event, fire, water, smoke, song, could be the same in any sacred ceremony around the world. The colors and smells may say India, but the flames could be the passing of the Easter fire in a Greek Orthodox church, and the blowing of the shell could be the sounding of the ram's horn at the Jewish New Year. The Arti ceremony is an ancient ritual that here has been modernized and brought to the river's edge to make it a nightly gathering spot for pilgrims. But I think it's great because it shows that religion isn't just static, it can evolve. Here you take an age-old custom, in this case, sending light onto the river, and you update it. Religion is at its best when it pays homage to the past, but it keeps evolving, and it shows that it's still alive. As the ceremony ends, the lamps and flowers slowly make their way downriver. Tomorrow, the pilgrims head the opposite direction, upriver, toward Allahabad. Dawn, the pilgrims are packed and ready to set off, with excitement and nerves.
We're kind of anxious to get going, you know, and get to the Kum.
You just have this anxious, you know, like things like a towel.
And fears about leaving the comforts of home.
And we have a roll of
TV.
Toilet paper. That's critical.
Did you see they were selling it? Did you see they were selling it down by the river?
That's a critical item for us Americans.
Like on any pilgrimage, part of the test is what you're prepared to do without.
I thought pilgrimage was about suffering. Wait, now you're talking about creature comfort?
Suffering is optional.
To get to the festival grounds, we have a 4-hour drive along India's greatest highway, the Grand Trunk Road. For 2,000 years, this thoroughfare has joined India from east to west, 1,600 miles teeming with life. As we travel, the pilgrims talk more about why they've come. Don Jensen is from Colorado.
There was a turning point in my life when I had been drinking a lot, and I needed to make a change in my life. It got to the place where I was extremely unhappy, and I was at a place in my life where I did not know what to do. And it was at that place that I became open-minded. And for me, it started with being open-minded, and then it felt like my heart started to open up a little bit to new ideas.
How does this journey fit into that journey you just told me about?
It's about opening my heart. And what I mean by that is I continue to try and keep my heart open. It hasn't happened all the times. There's times when I've gotten stuck. This particular point where I feel like I'm at is a place of opening, a place of shedding, a place of letting go, a place of transformation.
And what better place to do that than a pilgrimage? To come on a sacred journey is to strip away pretense and expose our raw selves. It's a process that grows more urgent as the destination nears.
Pilgrimages are very layered. There's the call, the leaving, separation. Now we're in this very distinct phase, the anticipation. We're excited. We're a little apprehensive. And I would say the biggest question everybody has is, am I going to get what I came for?
And then, at last, our first sight of the Kumbh Mela camp. A pop-up mega city on this legendary holy site. When the summer monsoon rains die away, the Ganges and Yamuna recede, leaving a wide sandy plain. Then, almost overnight, an army of laborers moves in, putting in power lines, streetlights, and water pipes, creating an instant metropolis stretching over 20 square miles. A city at its peak that will be home to 30 million people and visible from space. Just a few months ago, all this was underwater. Now it's a vast grid of streets with police stations, fire departments, restaurants, hospitals. It's a pilgrimage on a simply epic scale, but well organized too, divided into neighborhoods. Soon we locate ours. Each tent has its own address.
SD1, D2, SD3.
I think you're over here.
To be honest, I hadn't quite expected such plushness. Maybe Peggy was right.
suffering is optional.
Hey! Very incredible.
Is this like electricity? Do we have electricity?
What? Welcome to your chic tent by the Ganga.
Chic tent.
A working toilet and running water.
We're very impressed with our accommodations here.
We don't have any tea to offer you at the moment, but...
The Kumbh Mela is at heart an Indian festival. There are some class distinctions in housing, but in the end, the event is for the masses, drawing people from across the country and around the world. And for those streaming in by bus and train, the sheer grandeur is part of the appeal. A Hindu tradition, the focal point of the world. The group from Miami, Carmen, Jamie, Sadhu, and others, arrive as well. We're all staying in the same compound. What draws them here?
There's some sort of attractor that compels people to get on airplanes and to arrange their lives, to take time out of their lives to come to another land across the ocean, you know?
Pilgrimage is something that calls us deeper in our spirit, and it's not really logical.
Pilgrimage is and has always been a very compelling practice. The idea of traveling for a religious reason gives people an incentive as far as the potential for transformation in their lives. And the idea of going to the Kumbh, which is understood as the holiest time and the holiest place, manages to combine all those facets in one.
I've never seen anything like this before, and I am blown away right now, completely blown away.
Reza Parsiani is making his first trip.
And to walk in the footsteps of so many hundreds of millions of people that have been here and been doing the same ritual over and over again. So it's truly amazing.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Millions of people coming to this river. It's one of the most sacred spots on earth. Whether it's inherently sacred before they came and gave it that identity, or whether they have now made it sacred because of all of the intention here, I'm not sure, but there's just this beautiful spirit of gathering together for something spiritual.
Pilgrimage has always been central to Indian spirituality. Bathing in rivers, group meditation, and yoga are all ways to deepen the act of stepping away from your daily life.
Back in the States, the priorities tend to be focused, you know, and external indicators of success. So to see people so focused on an inward journey and a spiritual destination, internal or external, is really something amazing to see.
Many pilgrimages take place where rivers meet. In Sanskrit, a pilgrimage site means a crossing place. Here, 18 pontoon bridges link the terrain. From our camp, the best way to get around is by river taxi. For Shambhu and Peggy, this trip is an anniversary. Having met as college students in Wisconsin, they first came here soon after they were married.
Destination, internal or external, is really something amazing to see.
Many pilgrimages take place where rivers meet. In Sanskrit, a pilgrimage site means a crossing place. Here, 18 pontoon bridges link the terrain. From our camp, the best way to get around is by river taxi. For Shambhu and Peggy, this trip is an anniversary. Having met as college students in Wisconsin, they first came here soon after they were married.
When we came last time, I think we were at night. And after that, we left early, you know, so we didn't stay here that long. I think this will be really much more memorable, you know.
Definitely more memorable.
36 years ago, I was a young bride. All I knew is I love this good-looking fellow. I had really no clue where I was. So this is my opportunity now to come back to a pilgrimage of pilgrimages.
Indian religion has always been mobile. But in modern times, gurus have taken its traditions to the world. In the 1960s, it was the Maharishi with the Beatles. Before him was Yogananda, whose teachings inspired Shambhu and Peggy.
I'm looking in the Orange County Register, the newspaper, and I see a picture of Paramahansa Yogananda. And it says, under the caption, it says, original Christianity, original Hindu teachings. And I said to him, I said, wow, this is it.
I sort of basically brought the essence of Christianity and great parts of Hinduism into a very simple practice. Basically, realizing the self and finding God realization through the practice of meditation and yoga. So it made it very simple.
During their stay, pilgrims will practice yoga and meditation and listen to the teaching of gurus, especially Swamiji, a spiritual leader with millions of followers worldwide.
Sanatan Dharma's essence is living the truth, living the eternal truth. And all scriptures, all religions, they say, to love all, heal all, help all.
Originally, the guru was a highly qualified spiritual teacher and instructor. They are seen to have attained some kind of insight, and society accepts them as being qualified to teach. I think over a period of time, becoming a guru has become more a question of charisma, of appeal, of being able to speak to people about their concerns.
What is the greatest welfare for life? It's not the outside world makes you full, makes you happy, makes you complete. It's self and that connectivity to the self. And when this happens, then the true spirituality takes place in our whole life. Then minute to minute and moment to moment, you become full of spirituality, full of awareness, full of light, full of love, and full of peace.
Not just a celebration. The festival is like a giant spiritual teach-in with activities from morning till night. It's the perfect emblem for Indian life, as this quiet internal journey must coexist with a boisterous external one. One minute you're meditating and stretching, the next you're plunging into the crowds.
So we've just crossed the river and now we're going to go up into the festival area and see what we see.
At the heart of the spiritual city are the stars of the show, the Nagas. The naked holy men that are the public face of the Kumbh Mela.
The river is behind me. We've just walked through this giant outdoor market, and we're going to this huge, massive area where all the holy men gather to kind of open their tents for anybody to stop by. So we're going to go meet some of them. Okay, see you on the other side.
These holy men, or sadhus, like early Christian hermits or Buddhist monks, reject the material world and practice austerity, some with incredible feats of self-denial.
Once we start acknowledging that physical discipline is intrinsic to spiritual discipline, what happens if we push the body to its very extremes? In concentrating on that, maybe our spiritual focus will also increase. So long-time practitioners, especially amongst these renouncing sadhus, tend to put more effort into what might seem contortions, because by putting more effort in pushing the body to its limits, we push the mind to its limits.
some of these physical extremes are hard to comprehend.
So how long has he done that for?
For the last 5 years. And before that, he has been standing for 12 years.
So then after 12 years of standing, then he changed to sit and to elevate his arms?
Yes.
What should I learn?
When they can do to achieve something, why we can't? So this is a message. Do what you are doing 100%.
Even though 100% commitment is called for in the pursuit of enlightenment, one striking thing about Hinduism is that you don't need 100% commitment to one spiritual guide.
You don't necessarily always need to choose one, right? And so you can go and you can spend some time with one Baba. He'll tell you about his own philosophy of life, and then you can go to another, and they will talk to you as well. You know, you don't necessarily have to say, okay, this is my Baba, and I'm going to stick with it. People are not moving necessarily between traditions here so much as they are perhaps moving between different questions in their lives or different stages of their lives, and in which they're looking for certain kinds of answers, certain kind of guidance at specific times.
It's this open marketplace of spirituality that makes the Kumbh Mela feel so contemporary. In a world where everyone is searching for meaning, this is the ultimate searching ground.
I've been here almost a full day now, and it's not exactly what I expected. First, I would say, it's awesome like a lion in jungle is awesome, like the view from a mountain is awesome, like the birth of a baby is awesome. It just feels like this huge, grand human spectacle. Second, I would say it's ricocheting. I don't even think that's a word, but that's what it feels like. It's like you're in a pinball machine or a Japanese pachinko parlor or bumper cars. You're just constantly bumping up against things. And I guess the last thing I would say is it feels like an end, like a destination. And as long as you're going to have a pilgrimage and all these people are going to come here, this feels like you're somewhere, and it's somewhere really cool.
That sense of wonder surrounds you at all hours of the day and night in Kumbh Mela. An appreciation that in the headlong rush into digital nirvanas that characterizes much of the world today, there are still places, actual stretches of earth, where holy land and sacred water come together. A world where what we can see and touch and count.
Okay, brothers and sisters, I guess we get the message. This is going to not happen to finish tonight. I am a sad fairy. I just want to say that this report with the Kaiser report, they're really hard-nosing it. They're saying these guys are, as far as they are concerned, they are going to be hauled onto the table here. You know, it's just a matter of very short moments in time. So in behalf of the time that we have this very, very moment, I just want to wish that the connections of love stay with us and can't cry over spilt milk. This won't be able to be handled until Monday. It's infrastructure somewhere in the works. And so, Rama, you want to just see if we can play one song? Maybe I can finish that one song we were playing. And if we don't make it, everybody, I love you so very, very much, and my desire, I had so many things I wanted to complete here tonight. It's going to have to wait for another beautiful day, but I'm going to stick this back on where we were and see if we can finish one song. If not, we love you all, and the time is now, the place is now. Join us tomorrow with Cheryl Croce, and on Monday night, the energy is great, and it's 860-970-0300, and the PIN code for each evening is 946-7441 pound. And it starts at 9:15 Eastern and 6:15 Pacific. And we will spend 2.5-3 hours together to lift the energy up. Now let's just see how much more we can finish with this Christmas in Norway spirited, beautiful music. Let's see if we can do a little more.